This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 182. Today, we're going to talk about some news from Amazon Web Services, Microsoft, and Azure, as well as some container news, recorded live February the 21st, 2017. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by ShareGate. ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 365 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check them out on ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive. Hola, CJ.
Howdy.
How's it going, man?
Pretty good. How about you?
Doing pretty good. I'm pretty good. Fun week last week in New Orleans?
It certainly was. Yeah, I tell you what though, I have not slept like a log so deeply the last few nights as I have after that conference.
Wore you out a bit, huh?
It certainly did. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was wrecked.
I was fairly tame at that show, it seemed. I didn't want to go out because I wasn't very comfortable walking around. I did the half marathon the day I flew over there. So I was in a lot of pain walking around from not ramping up for the race as much as I would like to and then recovering the way you're supposed to. But it was a fun week last week.
Yeah, it certainly was. It was a great conference.
Cool. Well, hey, while we were there, we actually sat down with Ben Nyland from ShareGate. That's an episode that went out last week in episode 181. That was a really fun discussion with him and talking about the issues around, or not issues, but the change in the digital transformation that he was seeing with his customers and how office groups and teams, Microsoft Teams, are really affecting that. So I think it'll be interesting to see everybody's reaction from that episode. I know we do have another, we're going to interview someone else in the next few weeks where we're going to talk about extending Microsoft Teams and using bots and using Teams and creating new tabs and stuff like that. So that'll be a fun discussion with someone that we've been wanting to get on the show for a while, but you guys will have to stay tuned for that one.
Yeah, exactly. No, it was a great discussion. So, you should definitely tune in for that.
We also sat down and had an interview that we will publish next week in episode 183 with Nintex's Ryan Duguid, where he's the vice president of product over at Nintex. And we had a great, nice, long discussion with him about the state of kind of how you position Microsoft Flow and Nintex Workflow Cloud and all their products and how he kind of sees business moving in this space. Ryan's a good friend of both of ours. And so it was really nice. It was cool to sit down with him finally, get him on the show, but also just kind of get his insights on where things were. So that'll be a fun episode next week to share with everyone.
Yeah, they got some great product coming out. So, I've been friends with Ryan for a long time and they've been working furiously on this stuff the last wee while. Well, not wee, long while. And it was great to sit down and get his take on state of the nation on that stuff.
Absolutely. But hey, this week, what we want to do is we got a lot of news. I mean, we've had a sat down and did an interview with Ben and some other stuff that we've done recently. But I think that we want to cover some news because we've seen and collected quite a bit of stuff from the Amazon space, from the Microsoft and Azure space. And
Yep. There's
been a bunch of news around containers as well. So I thought that today we would get everybody caught up on some news. Some things we'll spend a little more time on. Some things we'll just do a quick little mention and provide links in the show notes that you guys can go take a look at after the fact. Or if you subscribe to our email list, you'll get an email with all these links in them too. So if you're not subscribed, please take a second, head over to the Microsoft Cloud Show and sign up for our mailing list. We only send you mails whenever we do a new episode, and it's got all the notes and everything in there. And it helps you help let us click on links in there and go to our show sponsors, show them some love since they do so much to help keep the show going for us.
They certainly do. We're very thankful.
So, hey, the first one that we're going to lead off with here that it'll be interesting to really see how this plays over the next few months is Amazon has released a new product called Amazon Chime, which is I'll read straight from their site, but Amazon Chime is a communication service that transforms online meetings with a secure, easy-to-use application that you can trust. It works seamlessly across your devices. You can stay connected. You can use it for online meetings, video conferencing, calls, chat, and to share content both inside and outside your organizations. My take, this is a competitor now to Skype for Business, to Hangouts, anything you use for video conferencing. They've got some good videos up on their site that show how Amazon Chime works and how they say it's different from other kinds of online meetings you do. To me, I mean, it still looks like just another online meeting. I'm not really sure how you can reimagine an online meeting, but it's nice to see someone else kind of jump into this space here.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, does it work?
It's a question we all have with Skype for Business, right?
Well, you know, Skype for Business, does work, let's be fair. But you certainly have your little difficulties with it from time to time. Let's just say that. And we used to call it link tax at the beginning of a meeting inside Microsoft, right? Even people would call it, you've got to pay the link tax, which was, you know, usually the first 5 to 10 minutes of the meeting is trying to get the meeting set up. And that's a bit harsh on it. It's actually, it's matured quite a lot as a product over the last 12, 18 months or so. But, you know, it still can be finicky from time to time, especially with external people. And I think that's really where Hangouts sort of ate Skype for Business's lunch, so to speak, in that it was just dead simple to get into a call. And it'll be interesting to see if Chime is as simple, what the setup is like, especially for external participants where they don't have the client installed or what have you, or the applications installed. That for me is like the real thing now. As a small business, right, it's easy to have internal meetings. I turn around in my seat and yell across the room. But ease of setup and bulletproofness really helps with external meetings with customers and partners and so forth, and not having to pay that tax up front of getting set up.
Yeah, that's the part. I mean, it was one of the things they highlighted in their little promo videos for Amazon Chime, where they were showing the pain of everybody jumps on a call and then you start getting like a minute or two into the call and you hear that little ding, someone has entered the meeting. It's like, sorry, someone just joined?
Yeah.
So it was interesting. It seems a bit pricey. There's three different pricing models. There's a basic, a plus, and a pro. The basic version is free and it's video calls for up to two people. You get one-on-one video calls, voice calls, but no screen sharing or remote control or recording of meetings, something like that. The plus version is $2.50 per user per month. And that one does give you the extra ability to do screen sharing and remote control. But what you don't get is you still only have a maximum number of attendees of just two people. So, I mean, it would work great for like you and me, but it still seems like that's still a little limiting. You don't just do one-on-one calls.
Yeah.
The pro version, though, that is where we can have meetings of up to 100 people, but that's $15 per user per month. And that just seems really, really expensive.
Smoke. That's insanity.
Yeah, that just seems really expensive. And I mean, you know, I have my issues with Skype for Business. I have a lot of issues with Skype for Business, it seems. I mean, it kind of works, but I constantly have these issues pop. I had one the other week where we rescheduled a meeting. And for some reason on my calendar, it showed up that it was 2 p.m. But for the three other people that were on the meeting, it was for 3:30 p.m. for them. So I sat on a call for 30 minutes waiting for them for a status call on a project, got a little bit out of shape, sent an email to everybody just going, look, I can't be successful in this project unless you guys show up. Mm. They all email me about 15 minutes into the 3:30 meeting and like, where are you? We're waiting for you. I'm like, oh, now I got egg on my face.
Gotcha. Yeah. I think for me, first up, $15 a month is complete and utter insanity. Like, I don't understand that at all. That's more than what people are paying for the entire of Office 365 in a lot of cases, three times more, in fact, for some folks. And yeah, that just seems madness, absolute madness. But I guess the price you want to pay for knowing it's going to be bulletproof and work every single time, I don't know. It also seems a bit strange that they're not doing something a bit more introductory, right? Because they're a brand new service and they want people to adopt it, pick it up. They're going to have to do something a bit different. And maybe it working is different, but I would have thought there would have been some other sort of hook to get people to try it out.
Yeah, the plus plan at $2.50 a month, it surprises me that you don't get things like the ability to do remote sharing or being able to join meetings on a standard phone line or something like that, or dial-ins or something.
Yeah.
But the one that blew me away is that only two people, for the first paid plan, you can only have two people on the call. But if you want, and then there's a jump from 2 to 100. But it goes from $2.50 a person to $15 a person. That blows me away, especially, I mean, we've got Skype for Business, but to me, Hangouts is fantastic. It works exactly the way it's supposed to work. The only limitation you got in Hangouts is, I think, 10 participants.
Mm. It's not a business tool, though. Like, there's a lot missing from Hangouts. I mean, sure, it does calls and it's bulletproof, right? It does it very well. But it doesn't integrate with your directory. It doesn't integrate with your calendar and stuff like that. From a business point of view, people on, using Outlook and more business-focused tools, I can see why they don't use Hangouts, right? But, you know, Chime, I think, will probably end up, well, it's kind of a business-focused tool, and will probably integrate with some of the other things from Amazon in that space, I guess. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. It's kind of it's interesting offering, so we'll see where Amazon goes with this and if they end up tweaking anything with it.
One side, it's going to keep Microsoft honest on the Skype for Business side. So they don't have a lot of competition in the business conferencing and telephony side, especially in the cloud.
Agreed. Oh, cool. So new offering there, new competition. Another bit of news that Amazon came out with was they launched a new Amazon Web Services artificial intelligence blog. Mm. So this is, to me, last year, 2016, was like the advent or the rise of all the orchestrators with containers. Artificial intelligence seems to be, or machine learning and deep learning seems to be the thing that's really taking off in 2017. So what they've done is they put a blog together to be able to link and bring together a couple of their different artificial intelligence capabilities that they have at Amazon. So they have things like different services like Polly Recognition and Lex. They have different platforms for machine learning and Spark ML, and then a bunch of different engines, things like TensorFlow, Apache MXNet, Cafe, Torch, Thenero, Keras. So there's a lot of stuff there. It really just wanted to mention on the show that they now have an artificial intelligence blog. So if you are in that space and you're watching what Microsoft is doing over at Azure with the cognitive services stuff, and you look over at the Google space, some of the AI stuff that they're doing, this is another one that you should probably have on your roadmap just to pay attention to what's going on in the landscape.
Yeah, it's nice to see them step in, right? Because they're one of the three or four big players in the space, and them talking about a little more is always good.
That's a wrap on our Amazon news. We got a lot of Azure stuff that we would like to cover as well today.
Yeah.
The first one, I would call it Azure, but I guess you kind of have to call it just Microsoft.
Welcome to the world of weird responsibilities inside of Microsoft.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so this one's going to be around Microsoft Flow. Last week was fun because I think that we got to sit down and I got to visit with Kathy Du, who was in town for the Nintex conference in New Orleans, and talk to her a little bit about, you know, what they were doing around Power Apps and Flow. Is that, you know, Kathy Du, the former Microsoft MVP that is now in charge of marketing for those two teams and the Common Data Service, the CDS. It was really interesting to hear kind of from her perspective a lot of the things they were doing, and to kind of take our discussion a lot farther than, you know, the discussion you and I had with Laura Rogers a couple episodes ago about Flow and Power Apps. So we are going to get Kathy on the show to talk a little bit more about the developer side in the next few weeks, months, and go beyond some of the stuff that we also talked about with Laura a couple weeks ago. But what they announced in the last week or two from the Flow team is a preview for something called Team Flows. And what these are is it makes it possible for multiple people to own and manage a flow together, so that, you know, if someone hypothetically left the organization, when they create a flow, it's not that when they get deactivated from the organization, from the directory, then you lose all their flows. That's kind of a royal pain, especially if you're using this for a workflow scenario. So that now this allows people to collaborate, work together to create a flow and have multiple owners to do things like read, update, delete a flow, view the history and debug them, add and remove other owners, and add and remove connectors that the flow has access to. It's pretty, to me, it's a pretty straightforward thing on what they're offering here. Just makes it easier management with multiple owners so that you do have more access to it.
Yeah, it kind of surprised me they didn't do this first. It's a business tool.
Yeah.
It's kind of supposed to be for teams and for businesses to create workflows to automate their processes. And it definitely confused me that they did the sort of the more personal and individual type access first. I think this is a complete no-brainer. I think the naming's kind of weird. Team Flows, but it's flows for teams, but not Microsoft Teams. There's a little bit of the organizational boundaries showing their colors there. But no, I think it totally makes sense. Being able to manage things together is obviously a complete no-brainer. Just sort of surprised me they didn't do that first.
Yeah. The different names that they use, you know, when they're using these just generic names, it does make it hard to... It does make it hard to kind of, you know, segment this between, not only between different groups at Microsoft, but, you know, exactly what this is all about. I mean, when we talk about, even last week when we were talking to Ben Nyland and jumping, using the phrase team, and, you know, when this team works with that, and you have it, you know, you got these teams doing this, and it's like, Are you talking about Microsoft team as in the product, or Microsoft team as in a group at Microsoft working on something? Or are you talking about a team as in like a virtual team? Or
it reminds me of the feature days.
Oh, Jesus.
Is that a little if or a big if? Just checking. Yeah.
And a solution, right? That's a fun joke with SharePoint.
Yeah.
I have a solution for your problem. You have an answer to the problem?
No. I've got a solution.
A bunch of stuff inside of it. A bunch of files and folders and features. Oh, new things to play with? No. Features, capital F, like with XML, more files and stuff in there.
Oh, dear. Yes, indeed.
Oh, well.
I've got something slightly different, more in line with the traditional Azure kind of news. This one is from Brad Smith, president of the Legal and Corporate Affairs Division at Microsoft. This is called Azure IP Advantage. And distilling all the buzzword bingo in here, pretty much this says, if you deploy in Azure with open source stuff, Microsoft will help you with intellectual property protection. And so they're basically saying, hey, if you use some of these open source tools inside Azure, they're going to help you defend against patent trolls, I guess, for want of a better word, by offering up 10,000 patents that Microsoft will make available to help you with counter-assertions against the aggressor. That's their words. 7,500 are available now, 2,500 are coming soon, and there's an FAQ to read about exactly how you'd go about doing so. But the idea is, I think this is another step in trying to make Azure look like a more friendly and attractive place to deploy your open source apps that use open source technology. Mm. And I actually think it's a pretty nice move. I don't know in practice how much it will be used, but it's a nice sort of feel good, we've got your back kind of move by Microsoft.
I'm curious to learn more about this, but it'd be nice to kind of get somebody from Microsoft to come on the show and talk to us a little bit about what this is and what they're doing here, because I get it from a concept point of view, but man, this just seems like it just can be an incredibly complicated thing to get into when someone comes after you and saying, oh no, you're infringing on this patent that I have for this open source thing that, it's this open source product is using this thing and I have this patent in it. So we're going to sue you and everybody else that's using this software for it. Then, Microsoft steps in and goes, oh no, because they're on Azure, we're going to protect you guys a little bit more now. It's like, how do you do that blanket statement when you don't really have control over what they're deploying and exactly what they're doing?
Mm. I think what they're saying is if you use tools like Hadoop, for example, inside Azure through this is the example they give. If you're using Hadoop through the Azure HD Insight, for example, and you're spending over $1,000 a month. That's the other thing. You have to spend $1,000 a month over the last 3 months to become eligible. Then if somebody sues you for some sort of patent issue from using Hadoop, then Microsoft is saying, hey, you've got access to these patents to help you defend yourself because you were just using Hadoop like anybody else. But because you're on Azure, we're going to help you defend against that. As opposed to you writing code that somehow infringes on somebody else's thing. I don't think they're covering you for that stuff.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that. It was just more, how you use the different products and stuff together. And I wonder if that goes into the gray area. It's a legal thing, so it gets definitely complicated and confusing, and you and I aren't qualified to go detailed into that area, nor do we want to do any recommendations there. But it's a curious move just to see more of what the details it's going to imply and bring us, and to see if the other cloud providers are going to do anything like this as well.
Yeah, as a startup, right, if I go use a service in Azure like HD Insight, it is kind of reassuring knowing that if some sort of patent issue pops up with Hadoop, that I may get some assistance with that.
Yep. Anyway,
so that's Azure IP Advantage. And there's a little video there from Brad Smith up about it that people can go take a look at, and we'll link to it in the show notes, obviously.
Mm, very cool.
Yes.
So I have a couple things here that I want to cover around Azure AD. And all of these three things came out towards the end of January, beginning of February. And they're all very, very cool, they're all very cool, very impressive things. One of them stands out a little bit more than the other ones, to me at least. But we wanted to give them a little bit of coverage here. So the first one is that now has reached a generally available milestone in Azure AD. New and enhanced access controls, specifically around tenant restrictions. And what this does is Microsoft has taken input from customers in the finance, healthcare, pharmaceutical, different industries that have very strict information access and compliance requirements. what these restrictions are going to do is they're going to give customers with these kind of requirements enhanced control over access to software as a service, cloud-based applications. So admins of these different directories can now restrict employees from using their corporate network to only being able to use Azure ID entities and tenants that they've been approved to be able to use. So there's a lot more details around this. A program manager from the identity security and protection team has an entire blog post that we will link to in the show notes that you can go take a look at. There's a little admin experience, an end user experience, explanation of how everything works. So it's pretty cool to go check that out.
Nice new additions.
Yes, that's one of them. The other one that I wanted to highlight here, and this is going to definitely get into be a lot more detailed, and I'm not going to try and go anywhere near explaining exactly how all this stuff works, but the same individual from the same team, from Yossi Benai, might get that wrong, they're announcing a public preview for Azure Multi-Factor Authentication Cloud-Based Protection for On-Prem VMs. And so what this does is it is NPS extension of Azure MFA. It's a cool enhancement that gives you the ability to protect your VPN using Azure MFA, which is included in Azure AD Premium, without having to install a new on-premises server. So that's a nice addition for those people who want to have MFA, all of the things, even those that are on-prem.
That's kind of cool. That's kind of nice.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I didn't see that news. I'll have to dig into that one. That's kind of curious because we use MFA to protect our Office 365 sign-in and all of that from Azure AD. Works pretty well with the apps on your phone and bits and pieces, so that's kind of cool.
I love the Authenticator app from Microsoft with your Apple Watch.
Yeah.
When I get an authentication request, I don't know if any of the guys in your office have an Apple Watch, but I get a little ding on my, where I used to get it on my phone, and then I'd have to either have a 7, so if I hold it down, I can do the force touch and approve it from that. But now it's just on my, I don't have to pull my phone out of my pocket. It's on my watch, just tap approve and it goes right in. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, it works on Android as well. Some of the Android watches, I think. I do look at that and think, the number of times I do that a day warrants me having an Apple Watch on my other wrist just for the Azure Authenticator app.
Almost 2 months now into having the Apple Watch Generation 2 and still love it.
Yeah, so. I probably do the MFA thing probably 20 times a day. It's obscene.
The one that I wish that it would do is they have, I use LastPass, and LastPass has their own authenticator thing, and they have a little app that, it's like an extension inside Chrome that it can go ahead and put your MFA code in there from, for certain sites, like it works for Dropbox, Google, and Amazon, but it doesn't have that. You still have to use the LastPass, fingerprint, touch, sign in, and everything to be able to get that to work, so you still have to use your phone for that, so.
Gotcha.
At any rate. Hey, the last bit of Azure AD news that I wanted to share here, this one was really cool. I wanted to give this a lot more coverage too, but I'm going to just mention a lot of the features here because I think it's only going to apply to specific organizations. This is some updates around Azure B2B, making cross-business collaboration easy. So they've got a bunch of new features and functionality. Let me rip these off real quick and people can go click through in the show notes and get more detail there. New user experience enhancements to the B2B admin experience, including the ability for admins to invite B2B users to the directory or to any group or application. Self-service invitation capabilities in the access portal, so information workers can invite B2B users to any self-service group or application they manage. The ability to invite a user with any email address to collaborate, whether he's got an Office 365 or an on-prem Exchange email address, or even an Outlook.com Microsoft account, or even social email addresses. They can now seamlessly access the invited organization with inline lightweight creation of Azure AD or a Microsoft account. Tenant-based branded invitation emails. That's pretty slick.
That's nice.
The option to build and customize the onboarding experience using invitation APIs.
Mm.
The ability to require and provide MFA to B2B guest accounts. That's really slick. The ability to delegate responsibility for inviting B2B guest accounts to non-admins, PowerShell support for B2B, and auditing and reporting capabilities. This is a huge update.
Is that all?
Yeah, but just 9 things.
And then? Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's pretty slick.
There's a bunch of stuff in the blog post has got a link to some more documentation, more details that you can find some more information about all these different features that they've added, as well as a link to the B2B collaboration talk that they did at the Ignite conference as well. So
gotcha. Wow, that is cool. They're making strides. I haven't actually dabbled too much in the whole B2B side of Azure AD. I should probably take a look at it. It seemed a bit, I guess when I did first look at it, it was a long time ago and seemed a little limiting, but obviously they're adding all the features that they need to get people using it. So sweet.
Yeah, very cool stuff.
I have got some more sort of traditional Azure-y kind of things, but why don't we jump into a word from one of our fantastic sponsors before we do that?
Sounds good.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid's motto is stay ahead. Its mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of IT. Valid is always on the lookout for new colleagues. Are you interested in all things happening in Azure, whether in infrastructure, SQL Server, Office 365, BI, SharePoint, or .NET? Look them up on Valid.nl.
All right, so we're back with some Azure storage news. On February 8th, Corey Sanders from Microsoft, who's the Director of Compute from in the Azure team, announced general availability of a thing called managed disks and large scale sets. Managed disks are kind of cool. I actually hadn't heard of these. I've obviously been tied up the last couple of weeks and hadn't really dug into it. But previously in Azure, when you created a virtual machine, it went and created VHDs, and you had to supply a storage account where it went and put those VHDs. General availability of managed disks means that you could sort of treat your storage a little bit more like PaaS, right? Where you create your VM and it helps you manage the storage behind the scenes. You don't have to worry about storage accounts and stuff like that. You also get things like snapshots of those. You can template them with ARM support, you know, through for Azure Resource Manager templates. You could do standard and premium disk types, all those kinds of things. But it feels like they've kind of abstracted that slightly further away from having to understand a storage account, create that first, all that sort of stuff, which is pretty cool, actually. Kind of nice. Makes managing your virtual machines a little bit easier.
Yeah, they did. I had the opportunity to sit down and do a usability study the day after this released with somebody from Microsoft. And the news around this really didn't cover all the stuff that they did with this. This is really impressive. Mm. So some of the challenges you used to run into with scale sets was that all of your VHDs went into one storage account, and that storage account had a certain number of IOPS that was limited to. So you had to handle, you know, different ones going into different VMs going into different storage accounts and making sure that you partition them out well enough so you weren't kind of overloading a storage account. Like you said, this treats it more like PaaS. You don't have to worry about that stuff. But some of the other stuff that they did that I thought was really slick, it's incredibly easy to use this too. The UI is very simple, but you have the ability now to take a VM, create a snapshot of it, and add that to your own galleries that you can create a new VM based off of that VM. Mm. And when you go to do that, it even warns you and says, hey, don't you want to sys prep this guy before you do that? So it's, I've done that in the past, but it was always a manual thing where it was, you know, create the VM, sys prep it, get into the command line, make a copy of the VHD, and make another copy, rename it, and all. They do it all for you. I was really, really impressed with how clean the UX was for this.
Yeah, that's really nice, actually. That whole copying based off something else is fantastic, because every time I've tried to do that, I've hit the whole, you've got to copy the disks around. Now you've got to make sure you've got a tool that copies it between storage accounts without copying it local, or otherwise you're going to have to transfer, you know, like 80 or 90 gigs of disk or what have you, mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. So it's pretty cool that they handle all of that behind the scenes. Mm. The second part of this announcement is about scale sets, and now they support up to 1,000 virtual machines in a scale set, which is a 10x scale improvement. So scale sets basically let you scale out virtual machines and manage them kind of as a single cluster or a group of machines. And so obviously that had demand for increasing the ability to beef these up and for use of things like Elasticsearch, which we actually use at Hyperfish, right? We use it for log aggregation and reporting about what's going on in our environment. But they've got a quote here from an Elastic software developer called Martin Lahman, I think. Elasticsearch, the leading open source data search solution, allows companies to explore anywhere from gigabytes to petabytes of data in real time. Managed disks and expanded VM scale sets will help Azure users deploy Elasticsearch clusters at very large scale. So I think the idea here is you can deploy a bunch of virtual machines, and then when you need to scale, a scale set makes that much easier to manage and sort of say, oh, now I need 500 of those, and there you go. Mm-hmm. So nice increase for Azure scale set support there. Excellent. We also have some announcements about storage price cuts. Price cuts in general. Virtual machines and blob storage price cuts. So the first one around virtual machines targets the F1 to F16 and A1 basic range. And those price cuts for the F range from 23% decrease to 18% decrease. The 23 is for Linux VMs, 18% decrease for Windows VMs. For A1 basic, could be anywhere from 42% to 51% decrease, which is a nice sort of set of price reductions for those. And they also give you a sort of sneak peek and say that they'll also be announcing price reductions for D-series general purpose instances in the near future, which is a far more common SKU, I guess, for want of a better word, of Azure Virtual Machines. The D SKUs are kind of the most popular, I think, from what I understand. We use a lot of them, things like that. So I guess we'll be having some price wars in the future around those as well. Azure Blob Storage as well has seen some price reductions. Hot Block Blob Storage down 26% and Cool Block Blob Storage down 38%, which is kind of nice.
Kind of nice.
Yeah, that's quite a lot. It's kind of weird how we sort of gloss over how big these numbers are sometimes, right? Because, oh, it's just a 38% decrease. Like that's nothing, whatever.
Yeah.
No, that's quite a bit. I've also noticed that Azure, not in this announcement, but just sort of as an ancillary thing, they've revamped their Azure pricing calculator online and made it a little easier to use as well. So should definitely go check that out.
Yeah, this blob storage pricing cut, this was a... Man, I'm loving this. The timing is perfect. So I'm in the middle. I have two NAS devices at home, and they both back up to Amazon Web Services S3 accounts. And I've got about, I guess, from all the video work that I've done in the past with Pluralsight, the stuff I'm doing now as well with Voitanos, I've got something like 14 to 15 terabytes of data that I replicate up to AWS after an initial big bulk load. And after looking at a couple different things, I decided I was going to shift everything over to Azure. And the reason I didn't start there is, number one, it's primarily the NAS device that I have. It didn't have an Azure client to it to where it could upload to it. So AWS was built in. But now there is a client that it can upload straight to Azure. But the thing that I really like about it is that if you've used any of the hot versus cold storage in AWS, which you just call normal S3, and then the cold storage is what they refer to as Glacier, you have to set up policies so that the data is moved from your hot storage over to Glacier storage. Glacier is significantly cheaper. The difference is that if you want access to it, it can take up to 6 hours to actually get to the data because they have to mount the data for you and stuff. With Azure, the experience is ridiculously simpler, not only in the management, but also data access, where now I don't have to set up policies. I just go into a storage account and it says, what kind of storage do you want, hot or cold? And I'm like, cold, please. And so now I've actually got a task, and I've been playing with it a little bit, on the weekends here and there, but I'm trying to set up a task that will run a complete transfer of all my AWS data over to my Azure storage so that I don't have to do that initial seed upload of like 14, 15 terabytes from my house. I know it's going to cost money to go do the data transfer across, but it'll be a hell of a lot faster using the AWS and Microsoft backbones than it is using my backbone. But I can't wait I'm going to definitely see a cost reduction between Amazon and Microsoft storage. I'm thinking, last I checked, it was going to be around 17 or 18%, and the experience is going to get better. And then now we're seeing for the UK South, they're saying a price reduction for cold block storage is going to be down up to 38%. I'm loving this.
Yeah, that's nice. Actually, do you know offhand if you can flip between cold and hot storage for a storage account on the fly?
I think you can. I mean, because it was just a little bit flag that I have on my storage account. So,
I wonder if you can change it after the fact. Because it'd be kind of cool to, you create a storage account, you start putting stuff in it, and then maybe on a timed basis, you kind of archive that and you flip the bit to cold storage, create a new one and use that for hot storage. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I use it for backups, for like remote backups and stuff. And like it's much, much easier. So yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. There's an announcement around, they call it storage service encryption for file storage in Azure. So if you're not familiar, Azure File Storage is actually pretty cool. And I only really learned about this a couple of months ago. Azure File Storage is the ability to have a storage account in Azure, obviously, but it be a file store that exposes SMB shares out to your machines and things inside Azure. So SMB shares, much like you would, you know, be able to access a file share inside your firewall, maybe on a server running internally. This kind of does the same thing in Azure. So you can have a file share that you expose to other virtual machines, whether they be Linux or Windows, and either, you know, sort of mount them as a drive, perhaps, inside a virtual machine, or just use the network to connect to it and start copying stuff across. We actually use it as well internally at Hyperfish for, sorry, not internally, as part of our production infrastructure for log file, archival. So we mount an SMB share into each of our virtual machines that on a timed basis, we run some code that copies all of our log files from those machines that we store on those machines as another copy for backup purposes and archives them off out to an SMB share in Azure File Storage and then whacks them off the local machine, obviously, to not chew up too much disk. But anyway, sorry, so that's kind of a little bit about what Azure File Storage is, but the announcement is actually around the ability to do storage service encryption on those Azure File Storage accounts. This was possible on, I can't remember exactly what types of storage accounts in the past, but you could turn on, you know, data at rest encryption on your storage accounts for certain types of storage accounts. And I think this announcement is about, you know, expanding that coverage out to Azure File Storage accounts now as well. This is completely transparent to the user. So you just literally click a text box or a toggle or what have you in the Azure portal, and you can turn on data at rest level encryption of your data. It's totally managed by Azure. So this is not bring your own keys from the customer, but it means that your data is sitting on a disk somewhere in an encrypted state, using 256-bit AES encryption. So I guess it's an expansion of their existing sort of encryption capabilities on storage accounts. But nonetheless, nice to know. For us, it's great, right? We're storing log files there, and it's always a good to add that little extra sort of bit of protection.
Yeah, it's just using the cloud storage side. I mean, it's so nice to be able to throw stuff up in this online archive that you don't have to worry about it anymore, and, you know, keep track of it everywhere else, and let Microsoft or let Amazon or Google, you know, store all that data for you and keep track of it. So
yeah,
I wonder if we're ever going to get to a time when there's too much data to be able to store, and they start to charge you for like old data that you're not. We were always told that, hey, you're never going to run out of GUIs. You're going to be fine. You know, IP4, we're going to be just fine with it. And then all of a sudden, we're starting to run out of GUIs. Let's go to IP6. So I wonder if one day we're going to hit that.
Not running out of GUIs, you mean running out of IP addresses, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Running out of IP addresses. If we tell us we're not going to run out of GUIs,
well, you know, never say never.
There's a finite number of combinations we can hit. So
I'm pretty sure the number of combinations of GUIs, though, is more than like the observable atoms in the universe or something ridiculous like that. Like it's huge. But never say never.
Beyond the universe.
Yeah, exactly. Jeez, man, that's pretty meta.
There you go. You like that? Hey, speaking of that, man, you know what I did last Saturday? It was freaking amazing. Or Sunday.
Well, I know what you did, but why don't you tell everybody?
Yeah. I'll tell everybody else what I did. I was down in Orlando, Florida, for a wedding. And on, thankfully, that day, SpaceX scrubbed the launch. But they were doing the first launch from Pad 39A, which is a... It's referred to as hallowed ground. It's where the Apollo missions flew. It's where 80% of the space shuttle missions flew. It's the main pad in SpaceX back in 2014. They got the keys from NASA and did some changes to it so that they could use it for their purposes. And went out to a little place called Jetty Park, which is a little park just south of Cape Canaveral. Stood there with a bunch of other people on a pier. Watched the rocket take off and watched the landing, the first daytime landing on land in person. And man, you've watched launches before. I've watched launches before. Absolutely blown away watching that firsthand. But I tell you what, you cannot prepare yourself for that double sonic boom when it comes down, when the rocket comes back in, breaking the sound barrier.
Oh man, that sounds super good.
It was funny because it landed. My wife had never seen a launch before, and it landed, and she's like going, I didn't hear anything. I'm like, just wait. And 2 seconds later, it's like, yeah. Bow, bow. It's crazy loud, but anyway, it's fun.
That's pretty awesome.
Hey, speaking of space and stuff like that, I got two bits of container news here that I want to share.
Hold on, yeah, so, it's a Tuesday morning, first thing for me-ish, and Yeah, I'm not sure how you're making that linkage, but roll with it, bro.
I did it anyway.
Yeah, totally.
All right, so I got two bits of container news. You get two bits, but I'm going to do the Kubernetes stuff. So first one here, this one, this is news from CoreOS. CoreOS has a product called Fleet, or they've been using this product called Fleet to help manage their, it's a distributed service manager that they've been using since 2014 to manage a lot of their container-based infrastructure. And CoreOS has been doing a lot of work around Kubernetes. Kubernetes is really just skyrocketing as far as in terms of one of the more popular orchestrators. I guess the three big ones are Apache Mesos, DCOS, Docker Swarm is the native one in Docker, and then the Kubernetes. Kubernetes being the one, we talked to Brendan Burns and Kelsey Hightower a couple months ago about this, the one that is open source project that's kind of came out of Google. They are now, as of February the 1st, 2018, so a good year away, the Fleet Container Engine, while it will still be available from CoreOS, it will no longer be shipped as part of the Container Linux. It will now, they will now default to Kubernetes and be a core contributor to the Kubernetes project. Another thing that came out around Kubernetes, this came out, I've been wanting to talk about this for a couple weeks here because it came out at the end of January. This one is really cool, and this is one of the one things that I have not... Let's take a step back. This whole concept of serverless computing, where we have things like AWS has Lambda, Google has Cloud Functions, and Azure has Azure Functions. Mm. One of the things that's always bothered me about Azure Functions is, and these other ones, is that there really is no good local development story. So I go through and want to do my local development. I can't really do that very easily and replicate it up to Azure Functions and see how that stuff works. It's not been exactly what I've been looking for. Mm. I like the ability, though, for Azure Functions to scale on the fly and me not have to worry about that kind of junk and just whatever it needs, just fire up and get going. But, you know, there's some downsides to using Azure Functions. Like I said, there's no good local development story. And it can also take a few seconds, I think up to 18 seconds, for things to spin up. Well, there's a new project that's kind of founded out of Kubernetes called Fission. And what Fission is, they are referring to it as FAS. Here's another acronym. Functions as a Service. Basically, think about it the same way. You build your function as a Kubernetes pod, which is basically a collection of multiple containers. It's kind of like how we look at services in Docker. We have a pod inside Kubernetes. Now, you build your pod, and Fission can, you then deploy your pod, you deploy it over to Kubernetes, and the Fission engine, the Fission framework, then will look and see how to go through and just spin up multiple instances of these and scale them based on the demand that's coming. So the thing that I thought was really interesting about Fission is it's giving me the same capability of what I want from Azure Functions, but it's giving it to me in a container deployment model, which makes it really, really easy to deploy, to build it locally, test, and then hand it off to the cloud and say, now you guys go deal with it.
Gotcha.
So I know that, you know, we got containers a little bit inside of Azure Functions. We talked to Scott Guthrie about that towards the end of 2016, but this one just kind of had one of those forehead exploding moments for me. I saw this going, this is freaking brilliant. At its core, the FAS framework must turn functions into services and manage the lifecycle of those things. And so it does that in a bunch of different ways. I'll have a link to it on the show notes here for people to go take a look at, but take a look at it. And it's got a nice little CLI based in it. There's talks about different scenarios for webhooks, REST APIs, bots, how you can handle events, and some information on the status and roadmap. Right now, it's an early alpha. It's not ready for production use yet, but they're looking for some early adopters and how to kind of move forward with that.
Wow. Yeah, I'll have to take a read up of that. Again, that kind of goes in my learn more about Kubernetes bucket.
It does. Right now, you'll like this too. I mean, right now, Node.js and Python are supported today, but they have preliminary support for C# and .NET.
Ooh.
It's impressive.
I may actually be productive with it. Nice. Yeah. On the container side of things, I've got some Docker news. Docker 1.13 or 1.13 is released, which is a bunch of new features, mostly builds on what started in Docker 1.12 with all the swarm mode support that was added in 1.12. But has a bunch of new sort of feature enhancements and so forth. There's lots of goodness around compose files, about deploying swarms and things. being able to say things like Docker stack deploy and pointing at a compose file, which is kind of nice. There's some CLI improvements, cleanup commands to help you manage your Docker swarm and Docker daemon locally, I guess, make it a bunch easier. Some monitoring improvements, which is nice. Things like Docker service logs is a powerful new experimental command that makes debugging services much simpler. Instead of having to track down the hosts and containers powering a particular service and pulling from those logs, Docker service logs pulls it from all the containers running that service and streams them to your console. That's really nice because you could have a swarm deployed across a bunch of different hosts and have to go track down logs. So that's a nice kind of way of making it simpler just to pull them from all of the things all at once. The big one at the bottom of this announcement that I thought was really interesting, Docker for AWS and Azure out of beta. So if you're not familiar with Docker for AWS and Docker for Azure, these are ways of deploying a swarm into AWS or into Azure and have Docker deal with all of the infrastructure provisioning and stuff behind the scenes for you. So you can literally fire up a new swarm in Azure and it will do all of the VM creation, storage account management stuff, VNet creation, IP address stuff, networking, all of those things and all the configuration for it. And then on the fly, once you've got your swarm running, if you put a service in your swarm that needs a particular port open external to the world, like for a website or something, then it will also interact with Azure and open that port up with the network security group for you and stuff like that. So it means that you're able to run a swarm much more straightforwardly in AWS or Azure without having to necessarily learn all the ins and outs and do it all manually in Azure or in AWS. It's kind of strange because this is like it's a one paragraph small little thing at the bottom of the post. But to me, it's like the biggest announcement in this list, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's just me, but I think one of the big pitfalls right now of Docker and the adoption of Docker for people in Azure is that it's still freaking hard to set up a set of machines in swarm mode in Azure.
Yeah.
Unless you use this.
It is. I mean, I agree with you. I was 1.13, it feels like it's, like you said, it's the continuation and the follow through on a lot of the 1.12 stuff. But a lot of the little things they added in 1.13, this one, the big one, AWS, Docker for AWS and Azure is out of beta. That's a huge improvement there to make it easier for us. But the other ones too, they barely even mentioned, aside from the CLI getting a lot of cleanup stuff after growing seemingly pretty organically, now having the ability to do things like even a build improvement. So if you build an image that has a lot of different layers that are involved with it, you can now use a flag called squash, and it will compress all the images down, all the layers down into just one bigger layer, which it's nicer for the management capabilities there. So you don't have to worry about, but in the past, you had to be really careful about how you crafted your Docker file to make sure you didn't create layers accidentally.
Yeah.
And now squash will do that for you. So,
well, the flip side of that is once you've squashed, right, when you need to pull a new version of the image, you're pulling the whole thing. Right, yeah. Not just the layer that's changed. Anyway, yeah, I just love this whole Docker for AWS and Azure thing at the end of the post. Like, oh yeah, by the way, we added the start menu back.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what? I was going down the list of things and I was like, cool, CLI stuff, some bug fixes, some monitoring improvements, but wait a hold on a minute. What?
Yeah. There was another bit of news in there too that I saw. They have an experimental Prometheus style endpoint. So Prometheus being growing in popularity quite a bit around your monitoring agent that's big in the container space, but in a lot of other products as well. Kubernetes has been adding a lot of hooks to it. I'm kind of hoping that we see in the build timeframe or around build timeframe. That sounds like I'm a Microsoft employee now. I'm secretly hoping some sort of an Azure announcement for a Prometheus offering as a service from Azure. I'd love to see that for being able to do monitoring. But
Yeah. It's kind of one of the big painful pitfalls of Docker right now. You've still got to roll a lot of that yourself.
Yeah, cool.
Final bit of Docker news, introducing Docker Secrets Management. If you've done anything with Docker, you'll know that your life sucks when it comes to managing secrets. And it just got a whole lot easier using Docker Secrets Management in swarm mode. So in a nutshell, for those of you who are not familiar with this stuff, you know when you've got a key for something, like a private key for SSL or some sort of encryption key or some sort of username and password or something for maybe a database server or something like that. those are what you call secrets, right? You're not supposed to give those out to anybody. Dealing with those in Docker right now is kind of hard. Most people do it as environment variables inside their containers so that when your app runs, it just reads them from an environment variable, can pick up those things and runs. The problem with that is maintaining them, managing them, knowing what's got access to them and stuff like that is hard. And so Docker have done a ton of work in the secrets management space with Swarm so that when you want to add a secret to your environment, you're able to kind of do it in a nicely managed manner, right? So it internally, it sets up the storage for these things that are encrypted and doles them out to workers and containers in a managed and secure manner, right? So they don't ever end up on disk unencrypted, for example, which is kind of one of the goals to make sure you don't have these things lying around. And it does so in a sort of a standardized way so that, you know, you can go create secrets in your environment. They move around TLS encrypted and so forth, but you've kind of got one throat to choke in terms of how you add secrets, manage secrets, remove secrets and things like that. To be honest, there's a million ways to skin this cat and 999,999 of them totally and the other one only barely. So it's nice to see some sort of, hey, this is the way we think you should do this inside Docker, because honestly, everybody's doing it different right now and they all kind of suck in one way or another and there's no great way of doing it. And so it's nice to see some native support added to Swarm to handle this.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Man. A lot of news here today.
Certainly is. There's a lot going on.
It's been a lot going on. A lot going on the last few weeks, but I know it's a bit of a longer episode for everybody this week. So I appreciate everybody sticking. If you stuck it all this far, thanks a lot for sticking around with us. But we will have links to all of these different things that we talked about today in the show notes to where you can go dig in and view stuff in a little bit more detail at your own leisure if you choose. But until then, CJ, hey. Another great episode, 182 is a wrap, and I will see you again next week.
Cheers.
Did you like this episode? Send us a tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Air by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.